Hey, everybody. Welcome back once again to the Psychology of Video Games podcast. My name is Dr. Jamie Madigan. I'm your host. It's my mission in this podcast and a few other places to dive into the psychology literature and come back with everything I can that will help you understand why video games are designed the way they are, why we behave the way we do when we play them, and why they are marketed and sold in the way they are. I do this every episode with the help of a guest expert. This is the episode about what mental health professionals need to know about video games, moral panics, and the WHO's recent ruling on gaming disorders. One quick thing before we get started. Remember that you can always go to psychologyofgames.com if you find any of this even relatively interesting. And there you can find, You can find a lot of different articles, hundreds, in fact, that I've written about the psychology of video games and related topics. They're all free and ready for you to view, just waiting for you. You can also find out how to follow me on Twitter, Facebook, other social media places, and how to get in touch with me. It may shock you to hear this, but not everybody is intimately familiar with video games. I know, right? Despite the fact that video games continue to become more mainstream and cut across all kinds of demographic groups, some aspects of games and gaming culture continue to be misunderstood or, worse yet, maligned. In past episodes, I've had guests like Dr. Rachel Cohort on to talk about what parents need to know about video games. That's episode 25. I've had Drs. Chris Ferguson and Patrick Markey on to talk about what policymakers need to know. That's episode 26. And I've had Dr. Vanessa Hemovich on to talk about what educators and institutions offering degrees related to creating games need to know about them. That was episode 34. In this episode, my guest and I are going to examine yet another group that may need to know some evidence-based information about video games: mental health therapists and similar professionals. That is, those working with kids, adults, and families who may not only be incorporating video games and play into their therapy, but who may be asked specifically about behaviors and habits related to video games. This is a good time to talk about this group, since video games and mental health have been in the news a lot lately, and clients may be looking for help with things that they've heard about. Violence in video games is an evergreen topic, and certain game design decisions around loot boxes and in-game progression systems have brought the topics of gambling and video game addiction to the foreground of public discussion. In fact, the World Health Organization, the WHO, recently updated its diagnostic standards to include gaming disorder as a mental health condition if a person meets broad diagnostic standards. This prompted a great amount of press coverage on the topic, and no doubt therapists and other mental health professionals have been fielding questions about whether or not somebody is addicted to video games. So, what do these professionals need to know about video games, gaming culture, and the way that games are designed in order to not just connect and have a meaningful conversation about something central to their clients' lives, but also to separate legitimate concerns from moral panics, fear-mongering, and pearl-clutching? What are those legitimate concerns about games, and how do you raise them? These are some of the things that I'll talk about with my guest on this episode of the podcast, Dr. Anthony Bean. Oh, and by the way, if any of this sounds interesting and you're going to be at the PAX West Expo this year, that's 2018 for any time travelers or archive divers out there, I'm going to be part of a much more in-depth and specific panel about the WHO's gaming disorder condition. In fact, this episode's guest, Anthony Bean, will also be there, along with Rachel Cohort, who has been on this show thrice before, as well as Ryan Kelly, Chelsea Hughes, and Rafael Bacamazzo. That's going to be on Sunday, September 2nd at 3:30 p.m. in the Cat Theater. If you're going to be at PAX, you should totally come by and say hi. And before that, on Friday, August 31st at 1:30 p.m. in the Sphinx Theater, I'll be on a different panel with some other fine folks about the psychology of moral choices in video games, which will also be a good time and which you should also come see. Thanks especially to my Patreon supporters, whose contributions are going a long way to offsetting the hotel, airfare, and other expenses for this appearance. You are all awesome, and I think about you all the time. Anybody else who wants to help out can do so at patreon.com/POG. Okay, and now on to the interview portion of the podcast. All right. Hi, everybody. Welcome. And thank you for joining me for the interview portion of the podcast. In this episode, we have Dr. Anthony Bean joining us. He's going to talk to us about a new book that he has coming out that is going to help clinicians deal with video games and some of their patients and other people who might be gamers themselves. And we'll talk about some other stuff as well. So, Anthony, thanks for joining us.
Absolutely. It's always a pleasure.
So who are you and what are you doing here?
So I like that. I am a clinical psychologist here in the state of Texas, and I run a nonprofit called the Telos Project in Fort Worth, Texas. And I'm basically a clinician and a researcher during my day and night jobs, and then gaming when, you know, whenever we have free time,
Right.
whenever that actually is.
So what is the Telos Project?
So the Telos Project is a 501c3 nonprofit here in Fort Worth that my wife's a psychologist as well, and we both run it together, and we have about 9 employees, all clinicians except for the front office staff, and we take all sorts of different insurances, all the Medicare, Medicaids, and deal with all the hassle of them. And we do a lot of psych testing and a lot of therapy for the community, because in this area, there's actually not a lot mental health. And we started in 2016, and we have grown from just me to those 9 people
Wow,
in just 2 years. And
that's
it's just,
fast.
yeah, it's super, super fast. And it's, we're very, very strict on who we let in, because there's not always people who understand how to really work with clients, I think, on a good level.
Right. So what kind of people do come through your doors, and who do you let in?
So our age ranges is, our youngest one is 2 years old, and our oldest one is 76
Oh, wow.
right now. So we see the entire spectrum, and we all have the different paradigms of thought. So I'm more Jungian, psychoanalytic. My wife's more psychodynamic, and then the other psychologist who's there is CBT. Then we have,
Cognitive behavioral therapy, right?
And then we have 3 different LPCs on board as well that just vary across their different domains of basically meeting the client where they're at. So kind of like more of that humanistic paradigm of thought, but sprinkling with the other stuff. And so those are the people we let in to work with us. And then all the people that come in are from all walks of life. We've had people that are very influential in the area come on in, versus people who literally have nothing in or were their last resort to really help out.
So what types of things do you help them with?
Depending on the client and the difficulties that they kind of come in with, some of them have been like, I don't know if I want to have a family. I don't know if I want to stay married, versus some people have are playing video games and they think that they're addicted and they want to kind of know a little bit more about what they're doing and exploration of their character and development of their choice of games.
Yeah, and how do video games come into what you do there? Because I know that your name comes up a lot on the internet and other places, sort of as related to psychology and mental health and video games. So how does that intersect with what you do?
Well, the idea of video games, when people first come in and they see me for a clinical interview, the first step in the process, they very much are like, "Oh, are we going to get to play video games in here?" And I'm like, "That's not really how it works." Sometimes we can incorporate certain games. So there's a special one that I picked up at PAX East this year, and it's called Beasts of Balance, and it's a really interesting game because it's all these like little origami animals, and you have to keep them alive by scanning them and balancing them on a pedestal. And it's super, super fun to do, and they give you points, and then you lose points when an animal has more points than the other one, so they lose life. You have to save them before they go extinct, and then you get to create and merge them, kind of like an evolutionary biology aspect.
Cool.
And it's super, super neat, but you can very easily use the mindfulness and other tactics in the psychology realm to do that. And I think that's really kind of how I incorporate the games in there is lots of people are making those games or just making games in general, and they believe them to be a little bit more aimed towards being therapeutic. But I'm of the variety that I believe that all games inherently can be therapeutic if the tools are used right, and if the one understands the game well enough. So let's say Pokemon, you can use it to really kind of serve anxiety or depression, basically, if you pretend that maybe your anxiety or depression is a Pokemon and you have to kind of catch it and hold it in and let it out at the right time or hold it on in. So it's really about using the dynamics found within the games to really further whatever the client in front of you is really working on.
Yeah, I can imagine younger kids reacting to that fairly well. Or heck, maybe adults as well.
We definitely have had adults throwing Pokeballs in the office, which has been very entertaining. If we could only videotape a 46-year-old going and throwing a Pokeball at a stuffed animal.
Generally frowned upon. No, so yeah. Yeah, I mean, you're one of several people that I've talked to in the last few years who are sort of incorporating games into not necessarily making the therapy about the game or the intervention about the game, but using it as a tool and a way to facilitate and a way to break through people to people who might otherwise not be as communicative or as interested in opening up.
Absolutely. I think that it's really easy to use the game mechanics, but you have to understand the different genres, the different areas of the game and kind of a little bit of the nuances within it. So someone who plays World of Warcraft, obviously there's a lot more character development on the surface level of that one versus someone who plays Fortnite, where it's more of a mix of Halo and Minecraft. And so there's definitely different aspects of that, but they can all be used in different areas if you know kind of where to pull the mechanics from.
Right. So that kind of takes us to the next question I had for you is that one of the reasons I wanted to have you on the show is that you have just released a new book. It's called, I think, if I've got it right, Working with Video Gamers and Games in Therapy, A Clinician's Guide. So who is that book for and what's that about?
So this book was a lot of fun and a lot of work to create. It's kind of a culmination of the last 5 to 6 years of me working with gamers and kind of trying out new tactics and different ideas of how do we relate to the different areas. And the main thing that I found out over this kind of journey, we'll call it, of psychology and becoming a licensed clinical psychologist, which is long and arduous.
So I've heard.
So I've experienced. And so as everyone else who has all that fun stuff, is that most clinicians have no clue where to go with video games. Mm-hmm. Is someone comes in there like, my kid's playing games a lot, and usually the first response is, well, have them stop. Instead of maybe the first question should be, well, what about that game is so enticing? Like right now, the big one is Fortnite. And yeah. TCU even called me in a few weeks back in April and wanted me to really present on for the counseling department, how do you work therapeutically with a game on this when it doesn't seem like there's anything that can be kind of used. Mm-hmm. And so this book came out as specifically a guidebook for clinicians, not like the end all be all books, but more of a guidebook for clinicians to really understand the gaming culture, the different nuances found within games. So it's got things of explaining different genres, mm-hmm. Understanding that a video game can be immersive instead of addictive, using a thing what we call an archetypal psychology based upon archetypal principles and their character creation, communication, online interpersonals, things along those lines to really give a good base for any clinician to then drop off and say, hey, I think I can play with this idea with a client differently now, and mm-hmm. let's try it out.
Yeah, so I got a copy of the book and read through, I'd say most of it. I didn't have time to get through everything before.
You didn't read all 198 pages? Come on.
Not so much. And I have to admit that I skipped the first chapter that was like, what is video game? How video game? I figured I was qualified to skip that one.
I would say that you're probably more than qualified.
Yeah, but I can see how having it in there would be valuable to people who are coming at this or picking this up because they needed that baseline. But yeah, there seems to be a lot of information in there about like how do people communicate through games and other technology mediated, you know, modes. What are game genres and what might that mean for different preferences and different types of people? What are moral panics around too much gaming or violence in games or game addiction, which I'd love to talk to you about later. And then sort of what are those archetypes of different types of heroes and different villains and different types of games, and how might that dovetail into, you know, therapy or attempts to connect with patients. So is it mainly then for clinicians, or do you think other people who aren't in that role would get anything out of it?
I think that anyone who can stomach the reading of it, and by that I mean, you know, as we write academically, sometimes it gets a little nuanced and jargony.
Right.
If people can read that, then I think that they would benefit very much from it. I've had some parents who have read some of the chapters before it was released to kind of understand a little bit more that their gaming interactions online aren't what they would call, and I'm doing air quotes right now, not real friends. And that's usually one of the main things that we have to target right away.
Right.
Is,
yeah, tell me about that.
So even today I did a clinical intake on a 12-year-old. And the mom was like, I don't want to, we live in the country and I don't want to take away his games because he thrives on those social interactions. And I don't want to call them not real friends because these are people he does know in real life and other ones he's formed close relationships with. Mm-hmm. But she goes, but are they really, you know, like, can we call them friends? You know, all you do is talk on a video game. And I would say that's exactly the definition of a friend is that you meet up, you play together, you're part of this immersive play, and you're part of the imagination of the game.
Yeah.
And that's really, really important to childhood, especially since we can now play with people across the globe. I mean, I play with people in France, in New Zealand, and in Canada are the three main areas, ironically, that
that's the whole globe that covers it.
That's it. We're done. We've just need to Antarctica. We're good.
Yeah, get the penguins in.
But it's kind of one of those things where we really need to broaden our horizons and ask questions about it rather than in what I think is happening in the world, condemning it or saying like, this isn't normal, this isn't right. And I think that that's a really small, narrow-minded focus of this. And I think that's kind of what us as researchers and writers are trying to change that perspective to say, hey, no, this isn't right. This is something that can be really worked with and understood. And it has its own culture. And it's not necessarily a subculture anymore. It's really growing in intensity, just kind of like how the Marvel movies have grown in intensity. I mean, it's coming out. It's almost bursting at the seams at this point. It's not going to go away.
Yeah. Yeah. I have those conversations a lot of times because both of my daughters play a lot of games and they will play or just hang out on Discord with people that they know in real life for the most part. And a few that they're like friends of friends. And my younger daughter in particular plays a lot of Roblox, which I assume
that's great game.
Yeah. It's like a whole platform for a whole bunch of different games, right? So she'll play all kinds of different stuff. And she will have friends from school on there and they'll chat and they will do different things, you know, play different games. And when we sit down at dinner, she'll tell us stories about, you know, so-and-so did this and then I did this. And then we all voted them off the island or you know, threw them in jail or whatever it is that they were playing. But I can see how there would be a question of like, well, you're not really interacting with these people. You're not doing it face to face. You're not practicing the same types of communication skills and nonverbal skills that you would practice. You're not necessarily sharing resources or doing favors for each other, which are kind of the building blocks of social relationships a lot of times. Is that a legitimate concern, or are the relationships that people have through games interchangeable with real, you know, with meat space relationships, or are they just different but also useful or not as useful?
I would say that they're just different. Having a medium of a computer screen or even what we're doing right now over an online connection, it doesn't mean that we're not necessarily not interacting, but we are having this conversation. We're having a flow and we are communicating on a different level. There's just a different medium on the inside. It was kind of the same thing with cell phones for a period of time, mm-hmm. where it's just a different medium. And like, oh, you're just talking on your cell phone to someone, you know, who's just down the street. This isn't like real communication at some point. And it's like, no, it's just a different medium, a different way of doing it.
Right. And does that have different outcomes in terms of how well-adjusted people are?
I think that it has its benefits and obviously has its cons, as everything can. The benefits are that I've seen is people who are usually a little bit more depressed or anxious tend to thrive a little bit more in the online interactions versus, and the reason is because it's kind of like a safe haven. There's a screen I can always, there's always like an unconscious ability to like, I can hang up or I can stop at any time and I can just end this conversation and that's fine. I can, that's my escape.
It's more difficult to do in real life. We have to turn and literally sprint away from the person.
Exactly. And then and then they brings on a whole nother slew of anxiety. Like, oh my God, what did they think of me? Who saw me do this? What are they going to do? what are, and it just catastrophizes it going forward. So for me, I see it as beneficial, but it does have its drawbacks because even when we do therapy over teletherapy, there's a difference in the session. It's not as personable, one would say. And it's really hard to, if you're not used to it, to get used to the idea that you can't always see the person and kind of get an idea of what they're going through because you can't see their entire body. Sometimes you can't see their facial interactions if you're doing it over the phone. I mean, it really kind of depends on what one is doing and how do we interact with it. And I think that's the key thing is it's just a changing continuum right now.
Yeah. And I've read some research that says that when people are using technology mediated or computer mediated or mediated through a game, that kind of interactions, that they're actually more likely to share intimate details about themselves or their life relative to doing it face to face.
Yeah, it's part of that like anon status there. It feels like it's not as dangerous and you don't have to, it's not as vulnerable making to open up when there's that medium in there because that person's not directly in face to face with you, which can be very anxiety provoking to a lot of people.
So what are kind of the most common questions or concerns that you hear about or that get raised directly to you about video games, either in people that you see professionally or just out there talking about what you do?
So the parents are usually is how much is too much? And there's not really kind of a good answer for that one because it's all client dependent. If the client, if the kid or the child, adolescent can manage themselves on a lot of different levels and monitor their gameplay, then chances are they can play more than someone who's like after 1 hour and the time limit's up and it's not that they necessarily can't stop, but they want to just keep going that one little thing, like, oh, let me get this one little quest done. Oh, let me get this one little thing here taken care of. It's a very different way of working with it. So that's kind of the main one. And then the next one always is, he plays violent video games. She plays violent video games. Is this going to make my kid into a sociopath or a psychopath? And then the answer is always no.
Now the kid's going to be a sociopath for other reasons.
Yeah,
nothing
exactly
to do with games. Yeah.
And then the ones that generally kind of come from the clients themselves are, I think I'm addicted to video games. And the question always is, what makes you think that? And they're like, well, I play this. I'm like, well, what about the other areas of your life? Are you still going to work? Are you still having family time? Are you making sure that you take control of your other areas of your life? Or are you secluding yourself? And we have to kind of have a different type of conversation about different boundaries. Mm-hmm. So it really kind of depends on what the client kind of comes in with.
Okay. So we have violence in games and too much gaming, too much screen time in general. And then this question of addiction to games. So one of the chapters that I enjoyed in your book was about moral panics, which sort of plays into all of these things, right? So can I set up, what is the idea of a moral panic and what do both clinicians and like anybody who is going to be talking about video games in any kind of professional capacity, I'm looking at you, most of the press, need to know about moral panics?
So the idea of moral panic, it kind of comes along the concept of there is a new substance of something, and substance is just a terrible word to use, but there's a new phenomenon, a new thing out in the universe. And at times it was rock and roll music, at times it was 10-cent comics, there was even pinball machines.
Chess at one point, crossword puzzles.
It's ridiculous.
A long list,
And it incites what we call like a fear type complex. And with that fear, it grows and people raise those concerns, and they're completely usually unfounded because there's no research or any ideas behind it, such as with rock music. Oh, people who are listening to rock music, they're going to be terrible people, and they're going to just go out and scream and yell and hurt people, and none of that is true.
Screaming and yelling, but yeah.
Well, screaming and yelling, I mean, that's in the music sometimes.
That's just good fun, yeah.
And so the idea is then that people take that fear and it gets elevated to a degree where it becomes a scapegoat. And off of that scapegoat, it just builds momentum. And this whole idea has been built up that this thing is bad, but there's no evidence for it. But it becomes a very dichotomizing variable where it's us versus them. And then these people call for a concerning vote to squash this problem that the society believes is a massive problem, and it's not really a massive problem. And then it just kind of research comes out and shows that it's not a difficulty or a source of concern, and then it just repeats with the next one. And so moral panic is just kind of like the idea that someone raises a major concern, it goes out of control, and then people are calling for justice to fix it. Which is always entertaining to see the little Justicars out there.
Yeah. And so this is happening currently with video games in the context of the violence, which is a recurring topic, and then also addiction as well, right?
Absolutely. It's happening now, and it'll continue to happen going forward, and it's just after video games, it's going to turn into probably virtual reality, which is part of video games. And then it's going to turn into something else, and then it'll just keep on going. It usually seems to switch every about 10 years, every decade or so.
So the scientist in me, though, has to ask, like, okay, there's false positives, but are mm-hmm. there anything over which people have panicked that did turn out to be bad or harmful? You know, like smoking or too much sugar in a diet or anything along those lines come to mind just out of curiosity? Or is it always wrong?
Well, it's not always wrong, I would say, but it's normally the things that once it gets into what we call kind of a societal belief that these things are wrong for people, that's when it kind of gets into an idea. So that sugar is a naturally obviously occurring substance, but it's also something that is widely accepted that, yeah, you shouldn't just have sugar all day because that's not going to be good. So that doesn't necessarily have like the same fear a motivator as, let's say, and I'm going to touch on a weird topic here, but vaccines. So we're kind of okay. Like in a little bit of that moral panic type thing on some of the areas for vaccinations and kids who or parents who don't believe that vaccines are necessary and cause cancer and autism and all those things, when all the research has completely shown that none of it is true. But that's kind of an idea of a moral panic that's on its, I would say, hopefully on its downward spiral at this point. And we're going to come to a point in that aspect where it's going to be an outbreak of something, and yeah, that'll just get nuts. But yeah, so basically there are things that are kind of out there, but I think the big one that's kind of in our area is that video games are addictive. But there's things in all different areas. Politics has their own. Social justice is working on the border stuff right now. Mm-hmm. And so there's lots of different things that are kind of going out, and it'll just continue on.
So sort of a classical moral panic, if you can call it that, is a situation where there becomes this distributed belief in society that something is bad, but there is actually a lack of evidence for it.
Yes, but even though with the lack of evidence, it still gets blown out of proportion because yeah. someone grabs onto it and says something that's pure, usually opinion, or and I hate to blame the media, but sometimes the media does go out of a little control and bastardizes the the concepts in some areas, and they report on like the potential adverse effects, even though there's evidence suggesting that this isn't really true. But it's right. kind of a way of sometimes selling papers, sometimes bringing the public's attention to it, and sometimes it's driven by the journalists themselves. But it does create sometimes a what we call a call for that confirmatory research, which then allows us to then say, hey, this isn't really as big as a problem as what one may think.
So if you're a parent or a policymaker or somebody else who's in charge of, for example, the lives of kids, how do you know if something is a moral panic or not? Or what are some good strategies for like figuring out how to approach this?
The easiest way is to do the research oneself and to look at what are the research studies that they're citing, because those are the ones that may be biased in one way, or it may be a correlational study, which is not really the best evidence, and they honestly shouldn't really ever be published, yet they are. Yeah. And once you do the research and you kind of understand what they're trying to get at, you're like, hey, that 3% drop, that's not really a too bad of an issue. Plus, it's correlational. Plus, you didn't add in all these other four variables that I think are really important. So I don't really consider this to be an issue.
This was done with an interview of 19 college sophomores. So, yeah, maybe we don't read too much into this. Yeah.
And that's kind of the idea of the easiest way to really get rid of a moral panic is to do the research yourself. However, most people
in society. That doesn't sound very easy at all.
Well, Google Scholar has made it much, much easier.
So you mean read up on the research yourself, not necessarily conduct the experiments. Okay,
oh,
gotcha.
Yeah. Oh my God, conducting your own experience. That's insane.
That's like, that's a whole nother level.
Yeah, that is. But, you know, reading up on the research, because when someone cites something or says something outspoken, they're usually going to have a citation, or then it's pure opinion based, and then you really shouldn't take that as fact either.
Yeah, if they don't have a citation, then that's a huge red flag.
Absolutely.
Already. Or if they don't refer to a body of research. So I guess at some point we need to talk about this World Health Organization classification of gaming disorder, which you've alluded to multiple times. So at the time of this recording, just earlier this week, right, the World Health Organization, the WHO, made official a classification for gaming disorder. I forget if it's called like internet gaming disorder or what the final designation was. But this basic idea is, as I understand it, that yes, this exists, that people can be addicted to video games in the same way that they are addicted to other things that we tend to think of when you hear the word addiction. So what has been your reaction to this classification? And kind of set it up and explain what it is.
So the classification itself is basically stating that, and this is, I'm going to kind of use some of their terms here as well. It's very broad right now. And their idea is that someone who games excessively, but there is no definition of what qualifies as excessive, mild, moderate, or severe, and has difficulties in a bunch of different areas, what we'd call different environmental factors or different environments, and doesn't have the ability to stop or continues on even though they know something is bad for them, then they can be considered what we call addictive. But the criteria says it has to be available and readily apparent for 12 months or more. However, there is a caveat in there saying that if the symptoms are severe, and again, they don't say what the symptoms actually are or what severe actually means, then the whole criteria can be discharged and the person can be given the diagnosis, which that is one of the major keystones of the dangers of this diagnosis, because it's now based upon a subjective experience of the clinician. And as we have very much learned, clinicians are not the most apt or knowledgeable in this area. Mm-hmm. And so for someone,
video games, you mean?
Yeah, in video games and gaming. And so when someone comes across them, they tend to really kind of focus in on, oh, you should stop playing. And then it leads down to this mindset of pigeonholing themselves. You're addicted. You got to stop.
So there's not a whole lot of detail around how to diagnose it. So tools. I know there's a list of things, and it's like it has to interfere with this and that, and it has to have been going on for, you know, this long, unless you decide that it's severe enough to just judge otherwise. Mm-hmm. But it seems like those criteria that a clinician might use to give somebody an official diagnosis that might then suggest some sort of treatment are kind of vague and could be applied to all kinds of different behaviors outside of gaming.
Yeah, we could apply it to very easily to football. A bunch of other different reading can fall into their jogging. I mean, it really kind of comes down to, you know, when you get on a really good groove of working out and everything like that, when you stop, you feel that in your body. And so one would say, oh, man, you're having workout withdrawals. You must be addicted to working out, using that same type of criteria. And if the symptoms get severe enough where, like, you know, you start having like racing thoughts and anxiety provoking issues and you become irritable, like, oh, man, hey, you're addicted to working out. Yeah. We can use that same criteria, which that's what in a sense makes it super problematic to have this diagnosis in those broad terms.
Yeah, and it seems to me that one of the, from my perspective as a non-clinician, I'm not that kind of psychologist, but as a non-clinician who is familiar with video games and hears a lot about this, it seems that just simply having that diagnosis be out there and official is going to cause a lot of people to self-diagnose or decide that, no, my kid or my wife or my friend is addicted. Like, this is a thing they must have this disorder. And it's, I don't know, sort of legitimizing it in a way that makes it seem much more common than it probably is.
Absolutely. Our research kind of shows that it's closer to that 1% variable intake rather than the 8-10% that's been thrown around for the last couple of years. And those are the good studies that are kind of like showing it's right around that 1%. Now, if we take in the whole 1% of the world population, that's quite small to kind of say like that. That's a lot of people that are addicted across the globe. And so to say that, and if we compare it to like, say, a depressive disorder or anxiety disorder, where the prevalence rate is much higher to that, between that 6-9% rates for either one of them, we're looking at a vast, you know, 600-800% increase in experiences of these types of symptoms, which obviously depression and anxiety have a much clearer definitions and understanding of theoretical underpinnings, which is also another issue that we're having with the WHO and this ICD-11 diagnosis. It doesn't really take into the idea of gamer psychology and gamer culture, which is amazing culture if one is willing to kind of go into it.
And there seems to me to be also a big difference between just being really engaged with a game and being into it versus being addicted to it. Over the weekend, I may play a ton of God of War because I feel like I'm getting to the end. I'm close, you know, so I may play it for like 8 hours on a Sunday that I don't have anything else going on. But Monday comes and I get up and I go to work and I don't even think about it. But it seems like a lot of people are going to get labeled addicted because, hey, it's summer break and kids are playing Fortnite for several hours a day because they don't have anything else going on. They don't have any other scheduled activities or their parents aren't making them go out and do something else.
Absolutely. And it's already started all that self-diagnosing stuff. I mean, there was a radio show over in California, and they let some people call on in and they let them self-diagnose right on the radio and no one stopped them. And the reporter just kind of fed into it and be like, oh, so you're addicted, are you? And would just let them continue on with that. I'm like, well, that's all leading questions and leading that person into a self-diagnosis, which is exactly what's happening out there for people who are not informed or not understanding these concepts, which makes it difficult. It's so difficult to combat it sometimes.
Yeah, and it almost seems like saying that you're addicted to a game is almost like bragging rights. And you even see it sometimes crop up in advertising for games. You know, I've seen ads that say, you know, introducing the most addictive mobile game ever or something like that, where it's like, well, no, thank you. You know, I wouldn't want that if it really were as addictive as, you know, drugs or gambling for some people or those types of things.
There was just a commercial tonight while we were having dinner on the radio about using makeup, and they used the form of the word addicted. I'm so addicted to this mascara and stuff like that. And I'm like, oh my God.
Are you like, you know, shooting it into your veins or what's going on here?
right into the eyeball.
You may be doing it wrong. Yeah. Come on, Courtney, cut it out. yeah. So what would you say, or what would be your sort of line of inquiry if somebody were coming to you and say, I think I'm really addicted to games, or I think that my daughter is really addicted to games. Like, what questions would you ask, and what additional information would you want?
The first question always is what makes you feel that way? What makes it seem that you're addicted? Tell me more about that. And usually they'll go like, well, I'm playing this game, and you know, I'm finding myself playing for like 2 to 3 hours at a time, and I don't want to stop. But you know, then it's time to go to bed at like 10, 11, and then I go to bed, and I'm like, well, it sounds like you can stop. which is like, sounds like you just did. And sometimes they kind of need that more of that reality check just right off the bat to know like, hey, no, you're doing okay. You're just enjoying a medium of a game. You're highly engaged with it. Versus someone with a parent comes in, all he does is play Fortnite. All he does is this. Well, why is he doing that? What's going on in his life? Well, he has good grades and he does these sports, but all he wants to do at home after dinner is play these games. Well, is he getting his homework done? Yes. And his grades are A's and B's? Yes. What's the problem? Well, he's not spending family time with us every moment. I want to know what he's doing with the day. I'm like, well, it's kind of seems like you might be a little bit of a helicopter parent.
Maybe he just doesn't like people who don't play Fortnite.
Maybe he just wants his own space, and this is his way to do it. And so it's kind of going down those lines of inquiries of what makes that game special for you, because every genre, every gamer plays a different genre or a mix of the genre. So like Fortnite, Halo, action games, they're not my bag. I don't really care for them. I'll play them, but I'm not going to be out there being like, oh my God, this game is so great. I've got to go there and play it. I'm more into the MMOs, the space exploration games, and the puzzles thinking games. So like Legend of Zelda, action adventure. That's my type of specialty in that area. And that's really, really where I love to figure out those puzzles and tinker with the game and see what can you try to break in it, because that's fun.
So let me ask kind of what may come across as a bombastic or even slightly offensive question for some of some of my listeners. How much is the video game industry to blame, at least in part, for this kind of heat that they're getting around addiction?
So that's a kind of like a double-edged sword question, as you've already alluded to. Mm-hmm. I think one of the big things is that the loot boxes are kind of what some people are picking up on, and some of the legislative politicians are really focusing on, but then they're generalizing it to all of the games. So the fact that there's a chance to earn something in a game, or a chance to really focus in on getting that one aspect or this one clothing, this one card or something like that, you know, it does have a driving effect. It does have that ability to really want us to play the game a little bit more, to try to get that, to try to attain it. There's like that completionist in all of us that wants that one thing, because once I get that, I know I'm going to like it, but then it moves on to the next one. So there's parts of the gaming world, I think, that are to blame for it, but at the same time, there's also what's the right word? Padlocks to make sure that there are certain things that are in place to not let gamers get a little too involved in it, such as World of Warcraft has those little messages, hey, it's fun to play in Azeroth, but also go outside and play with your friends, and just kind of like those little reality checks that do pop up. And Blizzard's usually pretty well known for them. Not every other system is, or game developer is, but most of them are pretty good with it, I think. But they are partially to blame, but it's not like that means it should condemn the entire industry.
Yeah, World of Warcraft even put in the rest bonus system, right? So that if you had taken a break from playing and then came back later, you would be rewarded for taking that break by bonus experience.
They even added in a secondary component to that, because originally it was no matter where you took a break, you would get that rested, but then they wanted you to get it to where it would mimic a save point, such as an inn or something like that, where you'd get double or triple bonus rested XP if you got to that point, because it felt like you could actually end the game right there, because you're at an inn, you're not in the middle of a battlefield, you can take that rest, and they're like, oh great, we're going to reward you. You get triple XP for the next 2,000 experience points that you make. And that's kind of their way that they kind of subconsciously and unconsciously kind of like move the gamers into, hey, take a break.
Yeah. So, you know, I think even if blame is not the right word, probably too strong a word, a lot of the way that games are designed is done to keep players playing or to get them to come back every day and play, you know, with things like login bonuses and daily challenges and, you know, first win of the day experience point bonus, you know, in games and loot boxes and all these types of things. And I am seeing them get more and more heat for that kind of stuff. And I even get fielded questions from time to time about, you know, aren't these things being engineered to be addictive? And are, you know, and my response to that is usually, well, addictive is not the right word, because when psychologists use that term, they mean something very different than lay people use and that you probably are used to using it for all the reasons that we just talked about. Right.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I say, well, look, they want to make their products engaging. They want to make them fun. And ultimately, so do people who make compelling television, you know, who build cliffhangers into each episode of their show, or, you know, people who write page turner books, do all that sort of stuff. It's not unusual or, you know, evil to expect people to want to use your product and be engaged with your product.
Absolutely. And that's kind of going into like a whole nother meta conversation of like commercialism and that the ideas behind that is I want you to come back, but I want you to come back rested and ready to keep on going.
And as long as you don't get too predatory about it, where you're starting to build systems in there that really do discourage that kind of breaks, that kind of resting, or that encourage people to do unhealthy things or spend money that they, you know, like, may not have to
like
spend.
The Harry Potter game that just came out a little bit ago.
What is that? I'm not familiar.
Oh, so there's a Harry Potter game that just came out, and there was a bunch of memes that came out of it as soon as it was released. I think it was a couple months ago or so. And basically, in the first one, the Sorcerer's Stone, there's kids that get tangled in the tree, and, you know, you have to just relax to go down into it and go underneath. And I forget the name of the tree in the Harry Potter.
The Whomping Tree or something like that.
So the Whomping's on the outside. This is when they're going down at the end to get there. Okay. And so in that game, there is
Whomping Willow.
that's the cool
it's
one.
All coming back.
There's this this other one that basically there's a kid trapped in it, and the kid's like tossing and turning, and it's saying, hey, you can wait 4 hours to have this kid calm down, or you could spend this amount of money to save him right now.
Yeah, gross.
And I was like, oh, guys, that's not how you're supposed to do it. Come on. But that's kind of like an example of a really bad way of doing it.
Yeah. Yeah, and I hope that there's kind of being a turning point with that sort of stuff in the industry. I mean, did you see Electronic Arts' press conference for E3 or a little over a week ago, where they basically came out and on multiple occasions during the press conference apologized for Star Wars Battlefront 2 and the whole competitive pay to win, competitive advantage, loot boxes, the whole progression system there.
Mm-hmm.
Seems like they're listening and taking it seriously. And I'm always in favor of self-moderation before somebody from the government tries to step in and legislate this stuff away.
Absolutely. And we already tried to have that happen back in the early 2000s, and it failed miserably. So,
yeah. So what then are some of the potential costs or harmful effects of playing a lot of video games, or are there any?
Yeah, there's always a harmful when indulging in anything for too long or too much of it. There's always going to be a drawback that you forget to do something, that you're not paying attention to another part of your experience, your life. And these things will always creep up. So video games are no different than, let's say, eating pizza or being really into baseball and going to all those games or coaching baseball and going and umping the little World Series and displacing your family for your other area because you really enjoy playing the baseball and coaching the kids. That right there can be seen as like, hey, dude, you know, that's a time management issue. And so everything, including video games, in the right context can be bad for you, but can also be good, in my opinion, if the clinician knows how to work with it and reaffirm boundaries.
Okay, so what are the potential benefits of playing games?
I think that games have the undeniable ability to allow us to play another person, to feel powerful on a lot of levels, and to really focus in on what we call that hero complex that we kind of all have. Like the model that I work from very much is based on the idea of the original character that you play in almost any game can be related back to what we call like an orphan archetype, which is someone who's been discarded, someone who's had a lot of loss in their lives, who is basically said in the beginning of most of the games, hey, you're not going to amount to anything, or you owe me for this. And so you feel like you're being judged or you're held back on some level. And that kind of creates what we call that orphan archetype, which is honestly what I think that a lot of us as we play games really kind of grab onto on a lot of levels. And when we grab onto that, we feel like we're related to the game on that level. And then we progress through the game and we progress through a bunch of different archetypal ideas, such as like the engineer, the competitor, the warrior, the mage or spellcaster, things along those lines, to we become what we call the hero of the game. And that really makes us feel very powerful and really important in the world. And then we can take that same projection that we put on our character, and we always have to psychologically retreat it out of the game back into us. And so if we look at it from that aspect, we are actually psychically in tune with our character, no matter which one we play as. And those same events that they go through can be related back to life events that most people have played, and also the things that they do where they may feel powerful but in the game but not in real life can then be related back and used for as a product of change.
Wow, deep.
Yeah, it's
fun. Seems like you've thought this stuff through.
a little bit.
A little bit, yeah. Awesome. So you are not content to put out just one book, but you've also got another one coming out early next year about the psychology of Zelda, the legend of, I assume. So what is that going to be about? Sounds like it's a little different than the clinician guide.
That one's definitely different, but that's also has its own avenue. And there's a reason I'm creating that, because obviously I'm hoping to then put out more and do a whole bunch of different games in the main genre, not the main genres, but the main games that have survived for decades. Those are the ones, there's a reason that they're still here and they keep on being redone on some level, even though they're kind of the same game in a nutshell, played over and over again. And so this one kind of goes into like the psychology of projection upon Link. There's even a feminism chapter on the idea of the benevolent ruler and the benevolent sexism. There's stuff on your personal journey, the hero's journey, and it's just all is meant to kind of give whoever reads it, not just gamers who have really experienced and wonder why maybe they like the game so much, but also clinicians, or anyone should be able to pick up this book and read it, because it's in enough layman's terms where they can then understand like, oh, this is why this game is so powerful. So it's kind of can be used in conjunction with this other clinician's guide. Like the clinician's guide is just a starter type set book, and that is just a kind of as a guiding force, whereas the Zelda is much more defined and refined into the game itself. And then you can start using those examples that you read about and be like, oh, I really wonder why you relate to Link so much. Is it because he really goes into that hero complex? Or what about him never having a mother or a father in any of the games over the 20 games that are out and available right now? In all of them, he doesn't have a mother or father. As an uncle, a grandmother, or even the Dooku tree has taken him up in some level. But he never has his actual parents there. And so you always start off
literally an orphan.
Exactly. Yeah. And so it kind of gravitates and pulls us on in. And that's the whole point of the book, is to really refine that and have an idea of how do we then relate to these characters on that level.
Cool. So what other franchises or game series do you think would be ripe for this sort of treatment? You should do Doom, because it would literally be wrestling with your demons.
It would.
It just writes itself.
You just came up with the title. It's great.
Yeah, wrestling with your demons.
We're looking. I have the writers who are interested in kind of doing Final Fantasy. I'm not opposed to Pokemon. Because Pokemon just keeps on going and going and going.
Pun intended.
Yeah, there, exactly. Yeah. and just kind of any of the other mainstream ones. But I was going to try to stay away from like Mario or any of those big, big ones. But we were just kind of looking into what are the ones that have just can stand the test of time.
There's a lot to choose from. Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thanks for going all through all of this with us. Where can people go on the internet if they wanted to find out more about you, your practice, your books, and everything else that you do?
Absolutely. So they can find me on Twitter. I am at VideoGameDoc on Twitter. And my practice, the nonprofit that we work with, is just the telosproject.org. That's O-R-G. And they'll find me on there, and the books will be on there. Books are on Amazon, obviously. If they buy them through the actual publisher, they discount them. So that's always a better route to go, in my opinion, although Amazon's faster. But you know, it's kind of the easiest way to do that. And we usually traverse the PAXes, all three of the major ones here in the United States, West, East, and South, every year.
Okay, cool. And what have you been playing lately? It's another question I always like to ask.
Yeah, it is a good one. So lately I have been playing Endless Space 2 and trying to make sense of the game mechanics. They change just so much from 1 to 2, and it is just like every race plays really differently. And it's so much more in depth, and they've reduced like the amount of planets you can conquer at a time, and then they threw in a planet cracker, and I mean it's so much more.
That's a real crunchy strategy game, right? Like what do they call it? 4X, like explore, exterminate, expand, et cetera, et cetera.
Absolutely, yeah. It's insane, but it's a lot of fun.
Yeah, I remember trying to play the first one of those and just got completely overwhelmed and was like, okay, I'm going to set this aside and try to come back to it later. And then I did not.
One I've beaten it on the hardest difficulty because there's a pattern to it. And once you once you do the pattern and you create your glass cannons and your tanks and everything, and as long as you can survive the first 50 turns, you pretty much can beat the rest of the game.
Can win it.
Yeah, pretty easily. This new one, nope. There's no sense, rhyme, or reason to it. At all.
Yeah, so I went back to Assassin's Creed Origins just because I dropped off of that and I want to finish it, and kind of made a deal with myself that if I finish this, then I'll pick up Dark Souls Remastered for one of the consoles. I might wait until it comes out on the Switch because I think having portable Dark Souls would be just funny for some reason. Playing through Assassin's Creed Origins, and man, that game, that world is huge. It's just it's gigantic, and I set my
great.
Little the Odyssey or
Odyssey, I think
Odyssey, it's, right? It's ancient, well, not ancient Greece, but set in oldie time Greece, prior even to the Egyptian setting of Origins. I just set my camel to autopilot to take me to the next waypoint, and like I'll just sit there and watch my little camel like run across the landscape for several minutes at a time. the game is just enormous and so detailed that, in a way, it's like it kind of bums me out because I'll never see all that sort of stuff. I mean, I wouldn't want to spend the rest of my life playing this one game, as some people do. But yeah, it's huge, and I'm just trying to kind of mainline the main quests at this point and get through that, and then maybe I'll just kind of go around and poke around some of the side quests before I move on to something else.
I think that's kind of how we all, once we get up to this level in our ages, we're like, hey, we want to play the game, but we're going to stick to those main things and we're going to make sure we can get there.
Yep. That's exactly right. And then I still play in some like Heroes of the Storm, which is the Blizzard MOBA game, which is sort of my, I need like a 20-minute break from, work or something else that I'm working on. I'll play a round of that. So that's what I got going on. So thanks again for coming on. This is all really fascinating stuff. And I always like having people on to talk about these types of issues, especially folks like yourself who have real expertise and experience with them, and who are not just sort of talking heads or like somebody like myself who just picks things up. People who actually experience these questions and these issues and helped people through them. So thanks.
Absolutely.
Yeah, thanks for coming on. All right. Thanks and congratulations once again for getting to the end of the episode. Remember, you can always go to psychologyofgames.com to find out more stuff like this, past episodes of the podcast, how to subscribe to the podcast, how to follow me on Twitter, Facebook, and all of that good stuff. And if any of you are going to be at PAX West this year, I hope to see you there at my panel. Talk to you then.